Thus have I heard on one occasion the Blessed One was wandering in the Kasi country together with a large sangha of monks. There he addressed the monks thus, "Monks, I abstain from eating at night. By doing so, I'm free from illness and affliction and enjoy lightness, strength, and a comfortable abiding. Come, monks, abstain from eating at night." When the Buddha first had a lot of, or had just a few monks around, they would eat in the evening, and that was when the best meals were. So they kind of complained a little bit about, but that's the best meal of the day. But the reason he said don't go out at night is because people go crazy at night when there's no light out. And they'd be walking around and they'd stumble into a cesspool or bump into a cow or scare somebody else because they were wandering. So the Buddha said don't do that. And actually, don't be afraid of being a little hungry. It's actually good for you, and you wind up having a much better meditation if you eat a lot in the afternoon meal, or the noonday meal, as they call it. If you eat a lot, by 2 o'clock you're ready to lay down and take rest because all of your energy goes to your stomach. That's when I suggest that you take a shower, not lay down. By doing so, you too will be free from illness and affliction. You will enjoy lightness, strength, and a comfortable abiding. Yes, venerable sir, they replied, then the Blessed One was wandering by stages in the Kasi country and he eventually arrived at Kasi town called Kitagiri. There he lived in the Kasi town, Kitagiri. Now on that occasion the monks led by Asaji and Punabhusaka were residing in Kitagiri. Then a number of monks went and told them, "Friends, the Blessed One and the Sangha of monks now abstain from eating at night. By doing so, they are free from illness and affliction, and they enjoy a health, strength, and a comfortable abiding. Come, friends, abstain from eating at night. By doing so, you too will be free from illness and affliction and enjoy lightness, strength, and a comfortable abiding." As a monk, I learned very early on that if you start to feel a cold coming on, you stop eating. Don't take anything. Just drink water and lay down and take rest. Take vitamin C, 1,000 every 2 hours. Take vitamin D3, about 1,500 or 15,000 units twice a day. And that cold will last at the most 1 day. anytime I feel any kind of illness coming on, I just stop eating. Now, there was a lady that she invited me to her house, and she'd been sick for about 2 weeks, and she was getting worse instead of better. And I caught whatever she had. And I had to travel from St. Louis to Washington, D.C. As soon as I got to Washington, D.C., I was pretty caught up in that cold because I couldn't take enough rest. And I wound up not eating for 4 or 5 days and just resting, sleeping. When my body got stiff, I'd get up and sit or wander around for half an hour or so and then lay down and take rest again. I found out later most people that got this illness, which was pretty severe for that time of the year, it lasted for them about 6 weeks. And I got over it in less than a week because I paid attention. The evening meal is by far the worst that you can put in your body. Because you put all this food in your body, then you're up for a little while, then you lay down and go to sleep. And your body has a hard time digesting it because you're not moving around. So, anyway. When this was said, the monks Asaji and Punubusaka Sukha, told those monks, "Friends, we eat in the evening, in the morning, and in the day outside the proper time. By doing so, we're free from illness and affliction and enjoy lightness, strength, and a comfortable abiding. Why should we abandon a benefit visible here and now to pursue a benefit to be achieved at the future? We shall eat in the evening, in the morning, and in the day, outside the proper time." Since the monks were unable to convince the monks led by Asaji and Punubusuka, they went to the Blessed One after paying homage to him, sat down at one side, and told him all that had occurred, adding, "Venerable Sir, since we were unable to convince the monks, we have reported this matter to the Blessed One." Then the Blessed One addressed a certain monk thus. Now the Blessed One had been staying for the range retreat there. And any time either one of these monks got close to where the Buddha was, they would disappear. They would go hide. So they didn't have to face him. Then the Blessed One addressed a certain monk thus, "Come, monk, tell the monks led by Asaji and Punubusuka in my name the teacher calls them." "Yes, Venerable Sir." He went to those monks and told them, "The teacher calls you, friends." "Yes, friend," they replied. And they went to the Blessed One after paying homage to him, sat down at one side. The Blessed One then said, "Monks, is it true that when a number of monks went and told you, friend, the Blessed One, and the Sangha now abstain from eating at night? Come, friends, abstain from eating at night. And you told those monks, friends, we eat in the evening. Why should we abandon a benefit visible here and now to pursue a benefit to be achieved at the future? We shall eat in the evening, in the morning, and in the day outside the proper time." "Yes, Venerable Sir," they replied. "Monks, Have you known me to teach the Dhamma in such a way as this? Whatever this person experiences, whether pleasant or painful, or neither painful nor pleasant, unwholesome states diminish in him and wholesome states increase. No, venerable sir. Monks, have you not known me to teach the Dhamma in such a way as this? Here, when someone feels a certain kind of pleasant feeling, unwholesome states increase in him and wholesome states diminish. But when somebody feels another kind of pleasant feeling, unwholesome states diminish in him and wholesome states increase. Here, when someone feels a certain kind of painful feeling, unwholesome states increase in him and wholesome states diminish. But when someone feels another kind of painful feeling, unwholesome states diminish in him and wholesome states increase. Here, when someone feels a certain kind of neither painful nor pleasant feeling, unwholesome states increase in him and wholesome states diminish. But when someone feels another kind of neither painful nor pleasant feeling, unwholesome states diminish in him and wholesome states increase. Yes, venerable sir. Now, when a certain kind of feeling, how do unwholesome states diminish? You're asking?
These six are the big explanation.
That's right. And that way wholesome states increase. Good monks, and if it were unknown to me, unseen, unfounded, unrealized, uncontracted by wisdom, thus here, when somebody feels a certain kind of pleasant feeling, unwholesome states increase. I like it, I want it. And wholesome states diminish. Why? Because you're taking it personally. Would it be fitting for me, not knowing that, to say, abandon such a kind of pleasant feeling? That's what a lot of monks do. Desire comes up. Let go of that desire. Of course, they don't tell you how. No, venerable sir. But because it's known by me, seen, found, realized, contacted by wisdom, thus, here, when somebody feels a certain kind of pleasant feeling, unwholesome states increase in him and wholesome states diminish. That I therefore say, abandon such a kind of pleasant feeling. If it were unknown to me, unseen, unfounded, or unfound, unrealized, uncontracted by wisdom, thus, here, when somebody feels another kind of pleasant feeling, unwholesome states diminish in him, and wholesome states increase. Would it be fitting for me, not knowing that, to say, enter upon and abide in such a pleasant feeling? No, venerable sir. But because it is known by me, found, realized, contacted by wisdom, here when somebody feels another kind of pleasant feeling, unwholesome states diminish in him, and wholesome states increase. That I therefore say, enter upon and abide in such a kind of pleasant feeling. Now you're getting to see more and more the importance of six aring. If it were unknown to me, they're unknown by me, but because it is known by me, contracted by wisdom, here someone feels a certain kind of painful feeling. Unwholesome states increase and wholesome states diminish. That's what happens when you run away from a meditation pain. Sometimes you need to, because it's so intense, because you lose your equanimity towards it. You're not in the jhana at that time. It's pulled your attention away from your object of meditation. That's how tricky mind can get. And you need to realize that the more you make a big deal out of not liking that feeling, the bigger the feeling becomes. So, develop your equanimity towards it. 6-R-ing isn't necessarily going to make it go away immediately. But we want fast results. We want it to go away when we want it to. And that means fighting with the truth. And we have to let go of all fighting, all dislike. Allow that to be there. When I was practicing a form of one-pointed concentration, I had extreme pain right there. Just like somebody took a red-hot needle and just stuck it in the middle of my brain. I had tears coming down. It was so intense. I wasn't crying. But it was very intense pain. So I went to the teacher and he just laughed and said, "Note it till it goes away." Well, that's the wrong approach. Because that basically means keep your attention on it and watch it. Watch its true nature. The heat, the piercing, the hardness, the movement, the vibration, all of those things. And if you keep your attention on it, you're feeding it. So the importance of the 6 R's is not keep your attention on it and relax and laugh with yourself a little bit about how intense it is. Come back to your object of meditation. Stay with your object of meditation until your mind is pulled away. Who's not smiling? Who's taking it seriously? Who's only doing a surface look at it with the underlying tendency to aversion towards it? How are you learning from it? The hindrances arise, not one at a time. They like to gang up on you. Because painful feeling can arise and there's aversion to it. And then there's all these restless feelings because of it. And what do you do with restlessness? It hurts. I know what pain is. I had 20 years of making it increase until I got developed equanimity towards it. Then I went to my teacher and I said, there's no way I can sit to make pain come up. Pain is a great object of meditation. Your mind doesn't go away from it so easy. And he laughed at that. He said, well, you don't have to have pain. Ah, okay. Therefore, I say, abandon such a painful kind of feeling. If it were unknown by me, but because it is known by me, contacted by wisdom, thus, here, when somebody feels another kind of painful feeling, unwholesome states diminish. So what's one form of restlessness? Trying harder to make it be the way you want it to be? Does that work? Then learn that. It's real natural to have restlessness come up, and you tend to continue pushing. And the harder you push, the worse it becomes. You can give yourself great headaches. Now, I've been a monk for 30 years. I've known meditation for 40. And I've probably had 5 headaches in my whole time as a monk. And they were physical problems. But I see tightness happening in my mind, I start relaxing. And I relax all the tension in my neck and anywhere else I feel. So, the only real headaches I've had is when I was sick, when my mind was out of balance because of the sickness. Okay. Monks, do I not say of all monks that they still have work to do with diligence? Nor do I say of all monks that they have no more work to do with diligence. I do not say that those monks who are arahats with taints destroyed, who have lived the holy life, done what had to be done, laid down the burden, reached the true goal, destroyed the fetters of being, and are completely liberated through final knowledge, that they still have work to do with diligence. Why? They have done their work with diligence. They are no more capable of being negligent. I say of such monks that are in the higher training, Abhidhamma, it means higher training. It's taken to mean higher philosophy, but this is higher training. Those minds have not yet reached the goal, who are still aspiring to the supreme security from bondage, that they still have work to do with diligence. Why is that? Because when these venerable ones make use of suitable resting places and associate with good friends and nurture their spiritual faculties, they still may be realizing for themselves with direct knowledge here and now, enter upon and abide in that supreme goal of the holy life, for the sake of which clansmen rightly go forth from home life into homelessness. Seeing this fruit of diligence for those monks, I say that they still have work to do with diligence. There's still more until you get to be an arahat. Monks, there are 7 kinds of persons to be found existing in the world. What 7? They are 1, liberated in both ways. Liberated in both ways means through practice and study, they are liberated through seeing and understanding. 1, liberated by wisdom, seeing dependent origination. A body witness, 1 attained to view, 1 attained by faith. 1 attained to view is 1 that hears the Dhamma and they understand it and they become a Sotapanna through that understanding. Now, of all of the students I've had, that's happened 2x. Doesn't happen all that often. We have an awful lot more dust in our eyes than than we can believe. 1 liberated by faith. You can become liberated by faith through really seeing for yourself that the Dhamma does work. A Dhamma follower, that means becoming a Sotapanna through the practice of meditation. And a faith follower, by having an understanding how these things work. What kind of person is liberated in both ways? Here, some person contacts with the body and abides in those liberations that are peaceful and immaterial. Well, abides with liberation, let's see. Some person contacts with the body and abides in the liberation that are peaceful and immaterial, transcending forms, and his taints are destroyed by his seeing with wisdom. What does that mean? I want a discussion.
Is that the error of the talents? Because it's
immaterial? Well, but they start with the body.
Contact by body.
When I start you with your meditation, you start by sending loving and kind thoughts to a spiritual friend. Okay, that's contact with the body still. And going up until the 3rd jhana, when you start losing that, and when you get to the 4th jhana, the feeling comes up into your head. And that's when I change your meditation. You go through the different kinds of beings, letting down the barriers. Okay, and then you get to the liberation that is peaceful and immaterial, transcending forms, that means transcending body, and his taints are destroyed by his seeing with wisdom. This kind of person is called one liberated in both ways, because you've gone through the material jhanas and the immaterial jhanas. I do not say of such a monk that he still has work to do with diligence. Why? He's done his work with diligence. He's gone through all of the jhanas and become an arahat. He is no more capable of being negligent. What kind of person is liberated by wisdom? Here, some person does not have contact with the body, but sees the links of dependent origination. I've had some students that the first day of the retreat, or by the second day of the retreat, actually, they've gone through all of the material realms. And they don't have any more contact with body and abide in those liberations that are peaceful and immaterial, transcending forms, but his taints are not destroyed by his seeing with wisdom. This is talking about getting to the state of anagami. You still have some hindrances. There's still some pride. You still have a little bit of restlessness and anxiety. Not anxiety, restlessness and torpor. But you become very familiar with seeing the links of dependent origination, and you actually start seeing that in all different ways, not only with yourself, but with other people around you. You see how it works. And you develop more and more equanimity to that. This kind of person is called one liberated by wisdom. I do not say of such a monk that he still has work to do with diligence. Why is that? He's done the work with diligence. Excuse me. That doesn't make sense. Okay, I see where he's going with this. Because of where he's... I haven't done this sutta in a long time. You can attain Nibbana at any time after you've experienced jhana. And I have had some students that they just got into the material realm. They had the cessation of perception, feeling, and consciousness. They felt very strong relief. They saw the links of dependent origination very clearly. Now, what happens is when you become a sotapanna, you're just going to see little tiny blinks, blips. Sometimes it's like bubbles, but they happen very fast. And you're not going to recognize that necessarily as links of dependent origination. When you get to the fruition, it'll happen again. When you get to Sakadagami, you're going to see the little blips. They last longer, about twice as long. And then there's big relief. And, well, actually the relief and the joy arise because of the understanding you have of dependent origination, but you still not might see it as closely as you can. When you get to the third stage, you will see the links of dependent origination very clearly, and you'll see them, the whole process, arise and pass away three times. That's one of the ways you know that you've become an anagami. And you're going to have very, very deep understanding of, yeah, this is the way it is. This is the way it works. It's not intellectual knowledge. It's realization. And when you become an arahat, you see it four times. So you have the best understanding that you possibly could of how the links actually work. What kind of person is a body witness? Here, some person contacts with the body and abides in the liberations that are peaceful and immaterial, transcending forms. At first, you have to go through that, and then transcending forms. That means getting into the mental realm. No more body. I don't care how much you talk about body at this point. It is all mental. And some of the taints are destroyed by a seeing with wisdom. This is the kind of person that is a body witness. I say of such a monk that he still has work to do with diligence. Why is that? Because when the venerable ones make use of a suitable resting place and associate with good friends and nurtures his spiritual faculties, he may, by realizing for himself with direct knowledge here and now, enter upon and abide in the supreme goal of the holy life, for the sake of which clansmen rightly go forth from home life into homelessness. Seeing this fruit of diligence for such a monk, I say that he still has work to do with diligence. What kind of person is one attained by view? Here, some person does not have contact with the body. He's mentally understanding and abide in those liberations that are peaceful and immaterial, transcending forms. But some taints are destroyed by his seeing with wisdom, and he still has reviewed and examined with wisdom the teachings proclaimed by the Tathagata. So he still has some mental work going in there. This kind of person is called one attained to view. I say of such a monk that he still has work to do with diligence. Why is that? Because that venerable one still has some fetters. Excuse me.
How do you turn this on?
Please stop forgetting that. Just as soon leave this on all the time. seeing this fruit of diligence for such a monk, I say that he still has work to do with diligence. What kind of person is liberated by faith? Here, some person does not have contact with the body and abide in those liberations that are peaceful and immaterial, so he's not in that state. And that means that he's either become a Sotapanna or a Sakadagami. By listening, you can become a Sakadagami if your understanding is deep enough. But some of his taints are destroyed by his seeing with wisdom. At least the first three are destroyed. Doubt, belief that rites and rituals lead to nibbana, and the belief in a personal self. Those are gone. And his faith is planted, rooted, and established in the Tathagata. This kind of person is called one liberated by faith. I say of such a person, of such a monk, that he still has work to do with diligence. Why is that? Because when that venerable one has not attained any higher, then he still has work to do. Seeing the fruit of diligence for such a monk, I say that he still has a lot of work to do, but he won't break any precepts. What kind of person is a Dhamma follower? Here, someone does not contact with the body and abide in those liberations that are peaceful and immaterial. His taints are not yet destroyed by his seeing with wisdom, but those teachings proclaimed by the Tathagata are accepted by him after reflecting on them sufficiently with wisdom. Wisdom here not only means seeing the links of dependent origination, but it also means seeing the impersonal nature of everything. That's what it's talking about here. So this is a person who has done the meditation and become at least a Sotapanna or a Sakadagami, and sees the true impersonal nature of everything. When you become a Sakadagami, you weaken lust and hatred a lot, but it is still there. It doesn't last as long, isn't mind isn't as troublesome, but you can still get caught up for a short period of time, and then you stop and you go, well, why am I doing this to myself? And stop. He has these qualities, the faith faculty, the energy faculty, the mind faculty, the collectedness faculty, and the wisdom faculty. This kind of person is called a Dhamma follower. I say of such a monk that he still has work to do with diligence. Seeing this fruit of diligence for such a monk, I say that he still has work to do. What kind of person is a faith follower? Here, some person does not have contact with the body and abide in those liberations that are peaceful and immaterial. and his taints are not yet destroyed by his seeing with wisdom, yet he has sufficient faith and love for the Tathagata. Furthermore, he has these qualities, the faith quality, energy, the faith faculty, energy faculty, mindfulness faculty, collectedness faculty, and wisdom faculty. This kind of person is called a faith follower. Just by, again, by listening to a Dhamma talk, don't let your mind wander. Be attentive. One of the reasons I started reading the suttas is so that you realize it's not coming from me. It's coming from the Buddha, so you want to be highly respectful and pay close attention. You see your mind wandering away, thinking about this or that, 6R, and come back. That's one of the reasons why I have you 6R-ing all the time. Because life is meditation, and meditation is life. This kind of person is called a faith follower, I say, of such a monk that he still has work to do. Why? Because when the Venerable Ones makes use of suitable resting places and associates with good friends and nurtures his spiritual faculties, he may, by realizing for himself with direct knowledge here and now, enter upon and abide in that supreme goal of the holy life, for the sake of which clansmen rightly go forth from the home life into homelessness. Seeing this fruit of diligence for such a monk, I say he still has work to do. Monks, I do not say that final knowledge is achieved all at once. On the contrary, final knowledge is achieved by gradual training, gradual practice, and gradual progress. Don't get caught by this. Venerable Sariputta, he did the meditation for 2 weeks. And he was fanning the Buddha while the Buddha was giving a Dhamma talk to somebody else. And he realized an attachment that he had. And he saw in the Buddha, he didn't even have an attachment to the Dhamma. And because of that, while he was fanning, he became an arahat. He went through all of the different stages just in a slight movement of the hand. So it can happen very quickly. It doesn't have to be gradual. But for most of us dummies, we got to go through step by step. And how is final knowledge achieved? By gradual training, gradual practice, and gradual progress. Here one has faith in a teacher, visits him. When he visits him, he pays respect to him. When he pays respect to him, he gives ear, listens attentively. When he gives ear, he hears the Dhamma. Having heard the Dhamma, he memorizes it. He examines the meaning of the teaching he has memorized. That's why I highly suggest memorizing the Chichaka Sutta. Has a lot of repetition in it. It's easy to memorize. When you memorize a sutta, that means you're carrying it with you. And you start using parts of that sutta with your daily life. This is not me. This is not mine. this isn't myself. He has memorized what he examines, and when he examines their meaning, he gains a reflective acceptance of the teachings. When he's gained a reflective acceptance of the teachings, enthusiasm springs up in him. When enthusiasm has sprung up, he applies his mindfulness. While having applied mindfulness, he scrutinizes. Having scrutinized, he strives. He uses the six R's whenever necessary. Resolutely using the six R's, he realizes with the body the supreme truth and sees it by penetrating it with wisdom. The body here is referring to the body of knowledge, not the physical body. There has not been that faith monks, that has not been that visiting. What? There has not been that faith, and there has not been that visiting, and there has not been that paying respect, and there has not been that giving ear, and there has not been hearing the Dhamma, and there has not been that memorizing of the Dhamma, and there's not been the examination of the meaning, and there's not been the reflective acceptance of the teaching, and there's not been the enthusiasm, and there's not been the application of mindfulness, and there has not been the scrutiny, close examination, and there has not been that harmonious practice. Monks, you have lost your way. Now he's talking back to these other two monks that say, I'm going to eat whenever I feel like. You've been practicing the wrong way. Just how far, monks, have these misguided men strayed from the doctrine and discipline? Monks, there is a four-phrased statement, and when it is recited by a wise man, would quickly understand it. I shall recite it to you, monks. Try to understand it. Venerable sir, who are we that we should understand the Dhamma? That's what these monks said back to him. Monks, even with a teacher who is concerned with material things, an heir to material things, attached to material things, such haggling by his disciples would not be proper. If we get this, we will do it. If we don't get this, we won't do it. So, what should be said when the teacher is the Tathagata, who is utterly detached from material things? Monks, for a faithful disciple who is intent on fathoming the teacher's dispensation, it's natural that he conduct himself thus. The Blessed One is the teacher, I am the disciple. The Blessed One knows, I do not know. For a faithful disciple who is intent on fathoming the teacher's dispensation, the teacher's dispensation is nourishing, refreshing, and fun. I added that last part. For a faithful disciple who is intent on fathoming the teacher's dispensation, it is natural that he conduct himself thus. Willingly, let only my skin, sinews, and bones remain, and let the flesh and blood dry upon my body, but my energy shall not be relaxed as long as I have not attained what can be attained by manly strength, manly energy, and manly persistence. For a faithful disciple who is intent on fathoming the teacher's dispensation, one of two fruits can be expected of him: either final knowledge here and now, or, if there's a trace of craving and clinging left, non-return. That's what the Blessed One said. The monks were satisfied and delighted in the Blessed One's words. So he cuffed him up pretty heavily, actually, by saying, anytime he called somebody a misguided man, it's like a real major slap. Because you don't understand the Dhamma. And you're not trying to understand the Dhamma. You have an opinion and a view that goes against what is being taught. And you're causing yourself immeasurable amounts of suffering. So being humble and respectful at the same time, and grateful. Those three things are really necessary for progressing. Not questioning, not making up your mind before you get to a certain place what you're going to experience, because you don't know. That's why being around somebody that has gone through the experience is valuable. Being around someone that can discuss how things work is really valuable. Now, one of the rules of the monks that's real big, it's a Parachika rule. It says that you cannot fabricate what your experience in meditation is. People nowadays, they say, I can't talk about what my experience is. Monks talk about their experience all the time. But it's real. It's not made up. So they can talk about, I'm a Sotapanna or a Sakadagami or Anagami, without breaking that rule. But only if they say it and it's not true, then that's a major, they have to disrobe. Yeah. So be careful of who you're talking with and how you talk about it. I won't talk about what level of meditation I am in with somebody that doesn't have what I think to be equal or better meditation. And I've told people in Malaysia that as soon as I get a student that becomes an arahat, I'm going to be his first disciple. Because I got a lot of questions. And I'm not afraid to ask them. Discussing what your progress is in the meditation when you're with somebody that has already had that kind of experience is helpful. They can help you to overcome some of the hindrances when they arise. They can help you to recognize when the hindrances are being sneaky. so you can start to recognize the aversion that comes up from a painful feeling is real. I don't like it, and I am there. That's the nature of a hindrance. So when a meditation pain arises, if if you stop making a big deal of it in your mind, and that's your own opinions and ideas about it, and just see it as, this is just a feeling. It's a painful feeling, but you don't have to suffer with it. The Buddha didn't. He had painful feeling arise in his body the last 3 or 4 years of his life. But it didn't upset his mind. Meditation pain is a kind of hindrance. And it arises because you're ready to start letting go of it. Be thankful that it comes up. It's your opportunity to watch how your mind has this aversion to it and soften and stop trying to control it. Back away. See, the whole thing with when you start getting deeper in the meditation, the whole thing is learning how to adjust your attention. And learning how to relax more into it without that aversion, without the dislike of it. The truth is, it's there. What are you going to do with it? You going to fight with it? Most of the time, yes. Well, stop doing that. That just causes more suffering, and it causes it to come around more. Until you learn, yeah, it's a little uncomfortable. No biggie. When I was in Burma, a dentist came around the meditation center and was going to clean my teeth, and he broke one. Oh, they said they had to do a root canal. Have you ever had a root canal? They drill about that deep into your tooth. It is very painful. But I had some other friends that had gone to dentists there, and they don't clean their tools in between putting them in this mouth and putting them in that mouth, so you wind up getting infection. I'm not about to do that. But I had to have a root canal. So I made sure that they boiled everything for a long period of time, used alcohol on the needles, or the not needles, because I didn't have any. I wasn't going to let them stick me with the needle with painkiller. So they gave me a root canal without painkiller. There was real pain. But as I started being more aware of it, I started relaxing with no more white knuckle on the arms, and relaxed. Had a lot of tension in my back, in my stomach, relaxed. When I relaxed that, I relaxed my mind. And I actually started sending loving kindness to the person that was causing me the pain. And then they'd hit another spot that was real sensitive, and it would jump. And there's all that tension back again. So it was a great learning experience on the impersonal nature of that pain. I didn't ask the pain to come up. I couldn't make it stop until it was ready to stop. And I did it so much And I was radiating so much loving kindness to the dentist that he wanted to make sure that he did a really good job, so he took longer than he needed to. But as soon as he stopped drilling and pulled it out and he said, okay, now we got to do this and fix the tooth, as soon as that pain stopped, my mind was exceptionally clear. Joy arose, not because I didn't have any more pain, it just arose because my mindfulness was so good at that time that joy arose. And I was happy. And I went from the dentist office to the monastery, and they all found out that I had to have a root canal, and they were all going, oh, that must have hurt. Well, yeah, it was painful. But I had so much joy, it didn't matter. And they were looking at my face, and they were going, boy, your face is really radiant right now. So these kind of things, although they can cause mental upset, don't have to, depending on your perspective at the time. And I've since had another root canal without painkiller in this country. Why would you do that? I don't like Novocaine. All it does is delay the pain. Yeah.
That was the next root canal.
Huh?
The next root canal.
It was more of the same. I know how to do it. And they still hit places that were very tender, and I still jumped, and then I had to 6R, and so. And actually, I prefer to go to doctors that don't use painkiller, because they have to be more careful, and they do a better job. They get into, well, I'll just kill this, and then I can go in there and zzz, 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 and they're not careful with what they're doing while they're doing it, and they can cause a lot of problems that way. So, it's a real interesting thing to realize that when meditation pains arise, that your perspective of it, your change in perspective of, I don't like it, I want it to be different than it is, all of that fades away, and then it doesn't matter whether it's there or not, because you're developing your equanimity towards it. So the pain will go away or it won't. Eventually it does. As you develop that sense of equanimity towards that sensation, you start getting disenchanted with it. And then there's no difference between a pleasant pain and a painful pain. A pleasant feeling and a painful feeling. It's the same coin, different sides. But when your equanimity is really strong, there's balance in your mind, then there is mind purification that's happening at that time. It's only a different kind of hindrance. You've already gone through how many different hindrances, but this one is a little bit more intense. So, Okay, so it's more intense. Sit with another 10 or 15 minutes. See what happens. If your mind starts to just say, okay, you're there, so what? Doesn't matter. Then you can sit for a long period of time after that. And your meditation gets better and better because of your change of perspective. I don't want you to sit in a way that causes the pain to arise. That's one of the reasons I don't insist that you sit on the floor. I don't actually want you to sit on the floor because you come from a culture where you've been sitting on chairs your whole life. Sitting on the floor means sitting cross-legged. Oh, you should sit in a full lotus. No, that's so painful, it's unbelievable. But they do it in India, and they do it in Thailand, and they do it in Burma, because they don't use chairs in their villages where they came from. They're used to sitting on the floor. Their hips rotate differently than ours, so they can do that without having a lot of pain arise, because they've been doing it their whole life. But we don't. So sitting in a chair is a good thing. There's only one problem with sitting in a chair that has arms on it, is you rest your hands and your arms can go to sleep. So take one of the thin pillows, put it on the arm, have your arm a little bit higher, it won't happen. But don't sit in a way that's causing pain to arise. That's what I did for 20 years. Not necessary. Sit comfortably. I had one student that they were really, really a good moral person. They kept their precepts very, very closely for years. They wanted to learn how to meditate. Okay, come this weekend, I'll teach you how to meditate. So I gave them the instructions, and after lunch I went around looking for them and said, how's your meditation going? And she said, you know, the meditation is good, but I can only sit for about 45 minutes. So that begs the question, why don't you sit longer? Well, I'm not used to sitting on the floor, and the pain is so intense, I can't stand it anymore, so I have to get up. So I told her, there's no magic in being on the floor. Magic comes from mind. Sit in a chair. Sit comfortably. Her next sitting was 4 hours. First day that she ever tried meditation, she got into the first jhana and close to the second jhana in one day. Why? Because she didn't bring up the pain. She didn't sit in a way that causes pain to arise. She sat in a way that is comfortable. And back in the day when I first started meditating, of course everybody had to sit on the floor or sit on a cushion or sit uncomfortably for long, what we call long periods of time, is a half an hour or 40 minutes. And that seemed like an eternity. Then I started sitting on a chair and went, I can sit for 2 hours this way. Easy. So, after 20 years of sitting cross-legged on the floor and having still some pretty sizable pains coming up that were real pains, I stopped doing that. I can't do that anymore. I have to sit in a chair. And because I was sitting for such long periods of time, between 6 and 8 hours without moving, these little things called veins and arteries are nothing more than hoses. And if you crimp the hose, the circulation doesn't work and something bad happens. You start developing blood clots. And that's what I had. And to this day, I don't have blood clots anymore. I know how to get rid of those. But the valves got stuck. So they don't open and close like they should. So the blood comes out of my legs, fine. But the valve doesn't close to keep the blood going someplace else in my body, and it goes back down into my legs. That's why I have swollen legs. That's why you see me hobbling around in the evening is very intense. But that was because I didn't do it naturally. I was pushing. But that's what I was taught to do. I was taught that you're not trying hard enough. You got to put out more energy. You got to put out more effort. And because of that and not having the relaxed step, I was practicing wrong concentration. And that's a major problem. So, because of the pains I've gone through in the past and learned from them, you don't have to do that. And I'm forever thankful of the Buddha when he was a bodhisattva and doing his austerity practices, that he would go to the end of whatever practice he was doing and say, well, that doesn't lead to Nibbana, let's not do that one anymore. And he did some really disgusting things. And he saved me from having to do it. And I'm forever beholden to him for that. I mean, he was drinking his own urine and eating his own excrement until there wasn't anything left in his body. He was sleeping on thorny places, like a bed of nails, that sort of thing. Well, that's certainly not very comfortable, to say the least. But he went through it, so we don't have to do it. An interesting thing, when he became a bodhisattva, his name was Samedho at that time, he had the potential to become an arahat within 7 days. That's how good a meditator he was. And when he made the determination that he wanted to be a future Buddha, one of the things that he said was, I want to practice in a way that it takes me 6 years to learn how to do this. And he made that part of his determination. Not all Buddhas are like that. Some of them, they're bodhisattva for a little while and all of a sudden they're a Buddha. But he made the determination so that people would be inspired to try harder. That he would go through all of these different austerities proving that they don't work. Because India, they've got some real strange ideas about what the spiritual path is. I mean, there's people that hold their hand up all the time. All the blood goes down out of the arm, and if they put their arm down, it's extremely painful. But they hold their hand up so much that it just turns into a skeleton. They think that's the way to attain nibbana. Now, if that's not weird, I don't know what is. I saw on an educational channel this one guy, he was called the Somersault Buddha, or the Somersault Yogi. And he was a master at doing a somersault. And he somersaulted 1,500 miles every day. He would start out, he had some breakfast, but it was before the sun came up. And then he would eat in the evening after they grabbed onto him and stopped him from somersaulting. And then because of that, he became very, very popular, and people would come to him in the villages and talk about spiritual things. But does that lead to nibbana? I don't think so. But it was really impressive. He didn't have a shirt on. He had a piece of cloth over one shoulder. And when he was doing the somersaults, it was almost like he wasn't touching the ground. That's how light he was with it. It was real impressive, but what good did it do? Every 10 years you get these yogis in India, they get together and they show off their own practices. One guy was standing on one leg for a long period of time, which is impressive. I mean, his sense of balance was very good. But how do you get enlightened just standing on one leg? What are you doing with your mind? But they have all different kinds of practices. Sai Baba was very famous for teaching his yogis how to hold their breath. And fasting. And going out into the Himalayas and getting in a mountain cave and living there for long periods of time. But they could hold their breath for, 30 minutes? Yeah, that's impressive. But it's also a very painful practice. To get through that, they had to go through a lot of pain, where their body felt like it was burning up, and where they felt like they were just the steel traps were pushing them in like a vice and things like that. But they do it over and over and over and over again and again and again. They can do that sort of thing. They cut the partition underneath your tongue so they could swallow their tongue. That stops the air from coming out of the mouth and nose. Yeah. Odd, isn't it? Well, they don't know about the 6 R's. My teacher said, and he did that. The Bon religion in Tibet is real interesting because you take a teacher, they're your guru, they're your epitome of purity, and you try to follow all of his actions with whatever he does, so you act in the same way. And you start visualizing him. And that's their spiritual practice. And they can develop some weird psychic things. But it's like, okay. And they have the rainbow meditation. And their body actually shrinks in size. By the time they die, they're only 8 or 9 inches tall. But they have this beautiful rainbow. Well, that sounds great, but so what?
Did you say 8 or 9 inches?
Yes. And they have pictures of skeletons in books. I don't know how, I don't know why. It just doesn't make sense to me. But they die with this beautiful rainbow.
They could see them somewhere.
Yeah. JT is taller than they are. But they believe that they're attaining some really heavy-duty spiritual practice. And they might be. I don't know. They might be getting into some Brahma Lokas that are really wonderful, that last for a long time. I mean, you get into the fourth jhana, and you never go any higher in this lifetime. When you die from this realm, you'll be reborn in a Brahma Loka that lasts for at least 500 mahakalpas. That's 5 expansions and contractions of the universe. That's a long time. There are 500 of them. One mahakalpa is an expansion and contraction. So they think that that's pretty neat. And it is. I mean, it is a pleasant realm. How they keep their body alive, they have a fine material body. How they keep their body alive is by experiencing joy. Every now and then. It's not like every day. So, a lot of my students, I tell them about it, but I don't think they really believe it. I get you to go to the realm of neither perception or non-perception. If you die and don't ever go any higher, you're going to go to a mental realm that lasts for 84,000 mahakalpas. And it is a pleasant existence, but it's not getting off the wheel. Eventually, when you reach that time, that massive expansion of time, you'll be reborn in a lower Brahmaloka for, say, 500 lifetimes or 500 mahakalpas, and then you'll be reborn in one that's only 10 or 12 mahakalpas. And then you'll be reborn into a Devaloka, like the 2 seat to heaven where Maitreya is. One day there is equivalent to 400 years here. So you still have a long time. After getting out of the Devaloka, then it's a crapshoot where you're reborn after that, depending on your past karma. You might be reborn in a hell realm. Might be reborn as a human being. Hard to tell. Depends on everybody's individual karma. But eventually, all the good karmic work that you did to get up to that realm is going to fade away. That's just the nature of existence. That's why it's so important to get off of the wheel of samsara. And there was a retreat I gave in Indonesia. It was a monk's retreat. There was 17 people that took that retreat. 15 of them got into neither perception or non-perception, at least. Some of them went deeper. 15 out of 17 is not bad. That's a pretty good percentage. And by the time I go back to Indonesia this time, they're going to come back and do a retreat, and then they're going to go deeper, become Sotapannas or whatever. But it was real interesting to have a monk's retreat just to see how well they did. The two that didn't do very well were new monks, and they had a lot to work with forgiveness. And they were pretty much attached. That's what happens with new monks. The first year of being a monk is by far the hardest, because you're not quite a monk, but you're not quite a layman anymore. And all of the padding you use for nasty things happening and all of that, well, that's taken away as soon as you become a monk, and it's more painful. And you have to learn how to deal with that and develop your equanimity and learn all of the rules and how to follow them. That's why you have to stay with your preceptor for 5 years, which is not done on a regular basis anymore, which is kind of a sad thing. They especially with foreign monks in Asia, they just say, well, if you want to become a monk, you got to go out and buy your own robe and bowl and all of that, and you have to give us so much money so that we'll ordain you. That's the extent of preparation they have. When I was in Thailand and when I was did this in Burma, well, not Burma, America, with Burmese, that was real interesting, finding out that they were kind of materialistic about it. I'm not that way. You want to come and ordain? I'll give you the robes. I'll give you the bowl to use. I'd like it back when you disrobe, because we don't have many bowls and they're hard to come by here. But if you want to keep it, it's up to you. It's yours. And to me, that's the right way to do it. And this year, I didn't have many robes given to me when I was in Indonesia. I only had 4 or 5 robes. If that, I just don't remember. But I've told them I can't use any more robes. I had to build another little hut to put the robes in, because I didn't have room in my kuti anymore. And they were always making the robes, especially, it was like a personal gift. They were making them to fit me. Well, I don't need that many robes. Get me regular-sized robes so regular-sized people can ordain. We had one person that was short. How tall is Zach? 5'2", 5'3"? And he put on my robe, and it was like, it was made for me. And he had to double it up, so it was hot. So every, at the end of the rains retreat, it's called Vesak, or not Vesak, Katina. That's when the monks are starting to prepare to go out after being in the one place for 3 months. And technically, the monks have to have white cloth donated to them, and they have to make a robe. And they have to make the robe, they have to dye the robe, all in one day. And they're tricky. Robes are not easy to make. And it has to be a full set. And then the person that gets the Katina robe, you vote among the Sangha members of whose robe is most shabby, who needs a new robe. And then the members pick that person out. And then all of the things that come on Katina Day, he's responsible for distributing among the Sangha. And that's a huge responsibility, and it means that you have to stay around that whole year. So that if there's any medicines that a monk needs, you can give him the medicine. Or they for some reason or another, need another robe, then you're responsible. And the shaving gear and the batteries and the the candles and the flashlights and all of that kind of stuff has got to be taken care of. And I spent one rains retreat in West Virginia with Bhante Gunaratna. And I did a lot of building. I did a lot of work. And it got time for Katina. And he just decided that he was going to give me a robe, a Katina robe, but I couldn't accept it because I wasn't going to stay there. And so the Sangha members had to get together in front of everybody else during the Katina ceremony and say, okay, who are we going to give the robe to? And then we had to vote, and the person that they gave it to was about the size of Zach. He was about 5'3 or 5'4 or 5'2, something like that. And they'd sent away and had this robe made especially for me, without telling me about it, of course. So when I said, I can't accept it because I'm not going to be here, I can't take on that responsibility for giving the things away, then we had to do some official acts so that we could give it to somebody else. And he had to wear that robe for the whole year. And it was massive on him. But it happened the way it was supposed to happen, I suppose. But I'd only agreed to be there for 3 months. And during that time, we had retreats there. And I got to give quite a few Dhamma talks there. But there was a lot of other monks. Some were senior to me and some were junior at that time. And it was an interesting rains retreat. I didn't want to be building a woman's cabin, but I wound up having to do that because nobody else had any skills and they didn't know how to build. So I had helpers, but I still had to do the actual stuff. So the way they were going to give me honor and respect was giving me the robe, although I didn't need it. I had plenty of robes with that that I was traveling with. So, interesting times. Now Bhante Gunaratana, as I understand, is not teaching anymore. He's older than Poonaji. And Poonaji, I think, is 85. So he might be about 86, 87 years old, and he's weak. So they got another monk from Sri Lanka, and they're starting to look at all of my YouTubes and starting to practice the way that I was teaching. While I was there, I had arguments with Gunaratana because he said he was very much against the Visuddhimagga, but that's what he was teaching. And I kept on trying to convince him that really you need to have more relax. You have to have that relaxed attitude. But I couldn't convince him. He was pretty set in his ways, and he'd done a lot of meditation on his own, and he knew the meditation he was doing, so he wasn't about to change it. But now that he's not teaching, the other teacher that came is starting to teach what I teach, and that's a good thing. So they'll get to be more successful as they get confidence in the way of doing it. Anyway, do you have any questions?
I have.
Okay. No? Any other questions?
You made it.
Okay.
Do arahats still need to meditate?
Need to? No. Do they? Quite often they do.
And just why? I mean, if the purpose of meditation is to take you to the end of the path and they've reached the end of the path, then
sitting in the cessation of perception, feeling, and consciousness is complete relief.
Okay, so it's okay. That was the question. It came up earlier in my head today. And also,
an arahat that sits in that, say, for 7 days and then comes out, they are such a field of really good merit that you run across somebody like that, you give them something. And it manifests in all kinds of wonderful ways. There's a story about Sariputta sat for 7 days. And he started walking down this little village path, and there was a farmer in the field that was plowing. And he had a water buffalo, but he was very, very poor. He was so poor that between he and his wife, they only had one shirt. Now they had a piece of cloth to cover their privates, but anyway, his wife, the farmer's wife, had just come out and was giving him food for his noonday meal. And he saw Sariputta coming and he gave it to Sariputta. And then his wife gave the drinking water to Sariputta. And Sariputta accepted it, of course, and went away. And the farmer started looking at his field, and all of the dirt that he'd been plowing had turned into gold. Now that's pretty good merit coming back at you for doing that sort of thing. And he didn't know what to do with all of that gold, so he went and visited the king of the realm and said, help me with this. What am I going to do with all this gold? So they were taking it into the palace and storing it for him so he could use it whenever he needed. And the men that came and started collecting the gold, putting it in a wagon, they started saying that this is not this farmer's gold, it's the king's gold, and it turned back into dirt. So they had to stop saying that. So after that, he could afford just about anything he wanted because of the power of giving to someone that is so wholesome. To start out with, it's a powerful gift. But to sit in Nirodha Samapatti for 7 days, I mean, every time one of my students does that, they come out just absolutely radiant. I mean, their face is clear and bright, and their composure is just, nothing can shake their mind. And one of my students, she helps me teach, she does the translations, and it takes a lot of energy and a lot of effort to do that. So she'll take off after lunch and sit for 15 or 20 minutes in that state, and that's like 8 hours of sleep. And then she has enough energy to keep going on during the day. So it's really, it's a useful thing. And I tell people it doesn't matter whether they're monks or not. If they're sitting in that kind of state, find something to give to them. Especially food. And if you saw the advantage of sharing your food, how many lifetimes it really matters. I mean, you can be born on a planet that has very little water and very little food, but you gave food to the noble Sangha. You're going to have food, you're going to have water, you're not going to suffer because of that. So it's a real good thing to give, especially when somebody is able to sit in that kind of state. And it's easy to tell when they get out. I mean, just looking at them, wow, their face is amazing. Any other question? Yeah? Yes, I do. I don't show them very often, but I have a place that it's my Anagami photo album. It's starting to fill up as nicely. There's a few in this country, not so many. In Indonesia, there's, oh, it must be getting close to a dozen. And in Sri Lanka, there's two or three, four. And in Australia, there's two in Brisbane at that temple. You wouldn't recognize them as such because they're not going to talk about it.
Famous?
Yes, they do.
Both famous.
Huh?
Both female.
Both female.
Both female.
And they don't act that much differently than everybody else, except they don't get excited, they don't have any fear, they don't have any anxiety, they just have this perfect balance. One of them is old and one of them is fairly young. Fairly young, in the 50s. But that's fairly young anymore. and one of them is working at a regular job. The other one's retired. She is old. So they're starting to be more and more. They're in Indonesia. The woman that is most responsible for me coming to Indonesia has set up a group of, what do they call them?
Mentors.
And to be a mentor, you have to be at least a sotapanna with fruition. She's got 25 people in the group. Is it possible to happen in this lifetime? I guarantee it is. Do you follow the directions exactly like I give them? That's the one. And when you do, don't believe me because I say it. Try it and see how successful you can become. And the rest is you and your merit. So, let's share some merit. May suffering ones be suffering free, and the fear-struck fearless be. May the grieving shed all grief, and may all beings find relief. May all beings share this merit that we've thus acquired. For the acquisition of all kinds of happiness, may beings inhabiting space and earth, devas and nagas of mighty powers, share this merit of ours. May they long protect the Buddha's dispensation. Sadhu.